Okay, thank you. What I'm going to discuss for the next 30 minutes or so is about basically interfacial spin wave coupling effects. And the main message that I want to deliver is its consequence is, can be captured in many parts by simple chirality. So let me begin by introducing my collaborators. Yes, this is my student who finished his PhD thesis in February, and he's now looking for a postdoctoral position. And the other collaborators are Kyungjin and Mark sitting in the audience. Okay, so this is the contents. So I will begin, I'll give you a very short review of recent experimental data. So there are a number of experiments on magnetic bilayer system where very thin magnetic layer is in contact with normal metal, usually some heavy metal. And very interesting phenomena have been found, and those effects may imply bulk spin wave effect or some interfacial spin wave coupling effects. And recently, it was reported that Zalutinsky-Moria type chiral interaction could be also important. Now, what I'm going to do is trying to demonstrate that chirality can arise very naturally from interfacial spin wave coupling effect. So I will start with the equilibrium situation. So from a simple model Hamiltonian of interfacial spin wave coupling, I will try to derive Zalutinsky-Moria interaction. And Zalutinsky-Moria interaction is known to generate chiral magnetic structures. Next, I will move on to non-equilibrium situation. What I mean by non-equilibrium situation is that now we apply some finite current. Then we will have spin torque, and spin torque will generate magnetization dynamics. And once magnetization dynamics is induced, we will also have a spin-dependent electromagnetic field. So I will discuss chirality features in these two non-equilibrium properties as well. And finally, I will present some questions of mine, which I don't understand. I hope some of you can give me answer. By the way, my talk contains about 40 slides, I guess, which is too much. And it's very likely that I can go over the time limit. So please give me a warning sign if my time is up.
25 minutes left.
Thank you. Okay, let me start with a short review. There were a bunch of experiments in this combination, ferromagnet and normal metal, and they could be platinum cobalt or platinum cobalt ion boron or tantalum cobalt ion boron or tungsten cobalt ion boron, and there are more examples. And in 2011, a group at Fangs reported that domain wall formed at this ferromagnetic interface moves very fast when we applied current. So here, if you see this plot, the domain wall velocity goes up as high as almost 400 meters per second, whereas in previous examples, the highest speed was something like 100. So something is enhancing domain wall speed drastically. And in this particular paper, they suggest that interfacial spin wave coupling may be playing some role for this data. And as far as a first principle calculation is concerned, we find that interfacial spin wave coupling, which is roughly a Rashba type, exists at the interface indeed. Okay, this is one.
What do you mean roughly Rashba type?
When I say Rashba, people usually deal with just a single band and quadratic dispersion. But here, these materials contains many bands, and dispersion is not exactly quadratic. So, that is not obviously exactly Rashba, but roughly. And there was also experiment data about magnetization switching. So in this structure of a platinum cobalt, again, the same Franz group found that current flowing along the platinum layer switches cobalt magnetization, and this is their data. And very similar experiment was also reported by a Cornell group, and their data is also very similar, but their interpretation is very different. So in this data, in this paper, they said that, you know, interfacial spin-over coupling is probably more important, whereas in this paper, they said that bulk spin Hall effect in heavy metal is more important. And in 2013, there were two experimental reports, one by MIT, the other by IBM, and both of them studied domainal motion. And from their study, they claim that there is some tendency to form a chiral structure. And what I mean by chiral magnetic structure is this. So here, there is a domain, magnetic domain where magnetization is pointing upward, and there is another domain where magnetization is pointing downward. Now, we can connect upward and downward domain in many different ways, like this, or like that, or like that. But according to their experiment, this magnetization profile in between follows only one particular type of chirality. So here, it is precessing like this. Always. So they suggested that something responsible for this is there in this setup, and they identified it with the Jabotinsky-Moreau interaction, which is known for a long time, and this is a very well-known expression for Jabotinsky-Moreau. So to explain this experiment data, we need to set the direction of this d vector along y direction. Then this cross product of a two neighboring spin should differ, should rotate around y direction to make this term small. So that is exactly what happens in this profile. And if I move to a continuum version, this term is converted to this type. And if I extend it, this 1D version to 2D version, this is the structure. And eventually, I will try to show that this a type of Jabotinsky-Moreau interaction appears very naturally from Rajpa type spin-only coupling. So this is the summary. So spin-only effect could be there, interfacial spin-only coupling could be there, and Jabotinsky-Moreau interaction could be there. And I will first try to present the connection between interfacial spin-only coupling and this DEM interaction. So how does interfacial spin-only coupling affect equilibrium property? Let me start with a very simple, naive analysis. So here is a three-dimensional structure, and I will simplify it to two-dimension. And I will simplify it even further to one-dimension. So I will just retain only this one particular direction and neglect the other two space direction. And let me model interfacial spin-only coupling by this single term, very conventional Rajpa term. And let me examine how this term affects the spin configuration in equilibrium. Let me think about two electrons, one moving to the right and the other moving to the left. And for the electron moving to the right, let's say K is positive, so P is positive, then P is along this direction, Z is out of plane direction, then effective magnetic field is out of plane direction. If the magnetic field is out of plane direction, then magnetization should precess, or spin should precess like this. So we should expect this type of spin precession as electron propagate. And in equilibrium state, we have exactly same number of electrons running in opposite direction. So let's take some electron with negative K. Now for negative K, effective magnetic field coming from Rajpa should be opposite, because the effective field, which is written in red, contains momentum itself. So effective field should be the other way around. So now it is pointing into the screen. Now effective field is pointing into the screen, then magnetization should precess like this. So electron propagating to the left should precess like this. Now, if we compare this precession profile of a right-moving electron and left-moving electron, we can see that they are the same. So in equilibrium situation, regardless of electron motion, direction, they always prefer one chirality. Now, up to this point, I have completely neglected the effect of exchange coupling with magnetism. So let me turn on now this magnetic coupling. So conduction electron couples with magnetic moment. And let me consider two special cases. Case one, where this magnetization profile itself is always anti-parallel to conduction electron spin direction. And case two, where this magnetization is homogeneous. In case one, here, let's suppose J is positive, then because this blue arrow and this purple arrow always anti-parallel, this energy is minimized. And at the same time, this spin configuration is exactly the one that minimizes this Rushba-Spinelli coupling. So both Rushba and this magnetic exchange, both are minimized. In case two, conduction electron spin direction and magnetization direction, they are not exactly happy with each other. So energy will be raised. Or if we this conduction electron spin direction is modified in such a way to minimize this one, then it will enhance this Rushba energy.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
On the picture above, when you talk about the precession of the spins, and here you're thinking of these spins being ejected from some place in a particular direction, but if you're looking at the Rushba, the eigenstates, they're pointing along the effective direction. So what makes them not point along the effective direction to create that precession?
Yeah, you're right. So yeah, you're exactly right. So this is just very naive argument.
Right, but where would they come from? I mean, in that naive argument, where would you have the spins arriving from the left and the right? I mean, there's not an injection of a source of the spins pointing to the right or to the left. In this case, you have them initially pointing to the
to
one side or the other. But,
So your question about what will determine the initial spin direction here?
Yeah, exactly.
Is it nothing to exchange?
Maybe it's in combination to the exchange.
Actually, yeah, if there is no exchange, nothing will decide the initial spin direction. But as soon as this magnetization profile is induced, that will try to set the direction.
Okay.
Yeah.
What you're now trying to do is find a simple picture for the calculations.
Yeah. This is not rigorous, just a very hand-waving argument. Yeah. So as far as this hand-waving argument is concerned, I hope it is clear that there may be some tendency to develop chirality in magnetization. And I will try to make it more precise. So now I will return back to two dimension, and this is my model Hamiltonian. So again, I'm using a very drastic approximation of a three-dimensional system by this two-dimensional Hamiltonian. And well, I know it could have a problem, but I want to study predictions of this very simple Hamiltonian. Okay, here now I have three rather technical pages, and I hope you survived without getting falling asleep. Then the remaining talk is trivial. Okay, let me first introduce some unitary transformation. It looks awkward, but what it does is actually simple. So it simply generates spin rotation around R cross Z direction. So suppose initial spin direction is something like this. Now, if I apply this gauge transformation, it produces this profile, which is, and here I've chosen this precession angle in such a way that it is proportional to Rushba-Spinelli coupling, and also a magnitude is chosen in such a way that this profile is exactly same as the precession profile caused by the Rushba. Okay, then I will try to calculate a transformed Hamiltonian. Then since this U is already taking care of this precession profile, then we may expect that this transformed Hamiltonian may not require Rushba at all. So, and actually if you do this calculation, this is what appears out of the calculation. So we have kinetic energy and no Rushba term. And so as far as Rushba effect is concerned, it is completely observed. We don't need to worry about it. The the problem has been mapped from an interfacial spin-orbit coupling system to something without interfacial spin-orbit coupling. So, and for a system without spin-orbit coupling, we know a lot. And we just need to make a back transformation to extract what happens if there is a spin-orbit coupling.
Does this work for all k? Or do you have to do it specifically for each k?
No, no, for all k.
For all k, and you get, so there's no difference in what angle your k are coming to be. That's a bit surprising, right?
Okay, to be precise, something extra actually occurs, but that something extra is higher order in spin-orbit coupling string, like, you know, quadratic or cubic. And from now on, I will focus myself to the first order. And as far as first order effect is concerned, I don't need to worry about those effects.
So, sorry. Higher order terms means at least second order in alpha.
Yeah.
So basically by this transformation you got rid of all first order terms in because it's included in this R.
Yes, right. So now I don't have interfacial spin-orbit coupling, but there is some cost. That is this change of exchange coupling structure. So originally, let's say this is the original exchange coupling, where this blue arrow represents the conduction electron spin, and purple arrow represents magnetization direction. And we know that this unitary transformation rotates the spin direction. Let's say it has been rotated to this direction. But we also know that this kind of unitary transformation should not modify value of this term. So M should be modified as well, in such a way that this inner product remains the same. So M prime now should be along this direction. So that is this M prime. So that is the cost. Okay.
From the surface, Fermi energy is not important in this case? I mean, both systems.
Okay, energy does not make any difference here. For all energies, I can do it. Small parameter is KR or alpha R, because I'm neglecting higher orders in alpha R.
Yeah, compared to what? Maybe.
KR.
Yeah. Okay, then now I'm ready to calculate equilibrium chirality. So let me calculate total energy of the ground state electron field Fermi C as a function of magnetization. If there is no interfacial spin-orbit coupling, then it is very easy to convince yourself that it should be of this type. If M is homogeneous, then conduction electron does not care about magnetization direction. Only magnetization gradient can affect electron energy. Now, what if there is interfacial spin-orbit coupling? In two previous pages, we've learned that Hamiltonian with interfacial spin-orbit coupling and for a generic magnetization profile, it can be mapped to a different Hamiltonian without interfacial spin-orbit coupling, but instead at the expense of modified magnetization profile. And for without spin-orbit coupling,
magnetization profile can be also initial can be any dimensional texture as well, right?
Yeah, for any arbitrary texture. So now then, for without Rauschenberg interface spin-orbit coupling, we know the answer. So we will use this expression, except that M should be replaced by M prime. Now, M prime was defined this way. M prime is some, you know, a rotated version of the original M. Now we have to calculate space derivative. Now M can vary in space, so that generates this first term. And the amount of the rotation, again, it is space dependent because it is designed to capture, you know, chiral precession profile of the Rauschenberg, and it again depends on space. So that generates some extra term, that is this term.
Can I ask a naive question again?
if I thought, I mean, so I was thinking of the chiral texture on the non-spinoid coupling, mm-hmm. and I do this local case transformation, one obtains kind of like an analysis of the topological Hall effect, kind of an effective spinoid coupling engaged, non-abit engaged field on a constant magnetization.
Okay.
And in this case, you don't, you know, when you do that transformation, you say you don't obtain any of that. Then. You just simply transform the magnetization only.
Yes, yeah.
It's not this, you know, if M was spatially dependent, you wouldn't obtain any sort of non-abit engaged field arising from it.
Right, yeah, up to...
So why wouldn't you capture, for example, the topological Hall effect if it was there? Meaning that if I did the transformation and I said, look, you know, I do have this Kermian lattice or something,
yeah,
and
yeah.
then I take the gauge transformation that maps it out, and you see
so,
my point?
So he's doing sort of the opposite thing. He's trying to...
Well, but I asked the question that, you know, if for M constant, I can see that. But if it's spatially dependent, would you obtain also an effective spin of a coupling from that transformation?
So if you choose a unitary transformation, yes, the answer is yes. And if you choose that to match the spin orbit coupling that's there, the two cancel.
No, that one, yeah, but not if the texture is not related to the spin orbit coupling, for example. I mean, that's
well, it's very
specific what he's saying. So then the question originally that M could be anything and then you obtain that and you map it out is probably not.
It is true that what he's describing gives you what the energy is for an arbitrary configuration. Right, so you take some magnetization texture without spin orbit coupling, you compute the ground state energy, and you discover that it's equal to that expression for the exchange interaction up there, because that's the only energy in the problem.
But if M is spatially dependent, you would also obtain, in the kinetic energy term, a non-abelian engaged field that has an effective spinoid coupling.
Okay, let me put it this way. So initial system...
is not related to M.
Yeah, so the initial M is, let's say, it's Kermian texture.
No, you only cancel the spinoid.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay, then, so now the remaining task is to insert this expression into here. And we see that if I compare the original expression without spin-orbit coupling and this expression with the spin-orbit coupling, we see that the only change is the replacement of the ordinary space derivative by this tilde shape space derivative, which is defined this way or this way. So, this tilde type derivative, we will call it a chiral derivative. And we will see that simply by using this replacement of ordinary space derivative by chiral derivative, we can capture many effects of interfacial spin-orbit coupling, not only equilibrium, but also in non-equilibrium situations.
Can you show the gauge transformation again?
Okay.
For
chiral.
But there's another dependence there. That would not give you...
but there's R dependence, so there's... Okay, the nabla on the R acts in such a way that you cancel the Rush bar.
That I understand. That's
but
no problem.
It doesn't affect M.
And you will not... That they will not appear in the kinetic term.
Right.
Okay.
Is it okay?
I hope so.
Okay, then, okay, let's just do it. Then, okay, here, this chiral derivative has this expression, so I will just plug in this expression into this line, then what I get is this. One term is just very conventional exchange energy, and there is another term which contains only one space derivative. And this is nothing but the Zalucinski-Moria interaction. So Zalucinski-Moria interaction arises very naturally from interfacial spin-orbit coupling. And there is a prediction about the value of this dm parameter, which is proportional to Rochebach spin-orbit coupling strength kr times exchange energy scale. And Okay, here we, I try to be a bit more.
It's a good point to mention that you have like 5 minutes for the regular talk.
Okay.
And let's say 15 minutes for the discussion.
Okay, then I should just speak really fast.
Keep, yeah, yeah.
or really slow.
Which one do you prefer?
I prefer slow.
Okay. Okay, I've tried a bit more realistic case. So I want to try non-quadratic dispersion. So I tried something very simple. I just converted this continuum Hamiltonian into tight binding. Then tight binding Hamiltonian will introduce a zone boundary, and their dispersion is not quadratic. And we just analyzed this Hamiltonian with non-quadratic dispersion, and we could show that the same relation between DM parameter and Rashba parameter still remains valid. So at least for a certain degree of variation, this relation seems to be valid. And chirality in non-equilibrium, okay. So again, I will use the same gauge transformation, and I will study the spin torque. If there is a no spin-orbit coupling, we know that there is adiabatic torque and non-adiabatic torque. Now, if there is a spin-orbit coupling, we know that something else appears. And here I will just apply this chiral derivative technique that we have learned from equilibrium analysis. So the only thing that we had to do is to replace space derivative by this chiral derivative, which contains actually one extra term. So if I do it, what I get is this. So from adiabatic torque, the expression changes like this. And if I expand this expression by using this, I get something else. And that something else is exactly field-like torque derived by these persons previously. And if I do the same thing for non-adiabatic torque, so here I replace this space derivative by chiral space derivative. Then I expand by using this equation. Then I get something else. And that something else is exactly Deping-like torque or Slonjewski-like torque derived previously by these people. So all this torque arises very simple way from this chiral derivative concept. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me skip this. And here, at this moment, I want to make a comparison between this analysis and experimental data. Okay, so from the theory, we know that DM interaction should have this magnitude. So I will compare this prediction with this experimental data from MIT, where they've done platinum cobalt ion. And they said that DM parameter is something like this, and the exchange parameter is something like this. Then if I insert that value to this equation, then as a fitting parameter, this KR, or Rashba spin-orbit coupling parameter, should have this magnitude. And then I will went on to field-like torque expression. Their effective field is just this thing in red. Now everything here is known. KR is known. The effective velocity is just some combination of material parameter and current density. So it is known for that particular experiment. So if I use this value, I end up with the prediction that field-like torque should be of this number at this current density. And in this experiment, they said that at the same current density, the effective field-like torque is 2 millitesla, which is about 2 times larger than this theory prediction. But considering large uncertainty in these values, I guess at least we can be sure that we are in the right ballpark. How about the damping-like torque? Damping-like torque contains not only these parameters, but also one unknown parameter beta. So what I will try is to find out the beta that can match experimental data. So experiment says that the effective field for damping-like torque should be 5 millitesla. And to fit that number, beta should be 4, which is very large. People usually say beta is somewhere between 0.01 to 0. Maybe 2 or 3. And this is too large. So one possibility is that spin hold effect may be one possible answer. Or this Berry phase contribution, like proposed by Hiro, could be one answer. I don't know which one is the right one. Okay, so my time is up. Should I stop here or can I speak a little bit more?
How much more?
Let me see.
I mean, if there are still 20 slides to go, I would say that's too much.
Can I ask a question about the previous slide?
Yeah, maybe we can move the discussion here.
And our question is, what did it take for example, for the polarization?
I just borrowed the number given in this paper. So I don't know exactly remember the number. It should be something like 0.5 or something.
There was somehow a slight inconsistency in the story that, as far as I understand from the experiments, the non-adiabatic and the adiabatic torque are basically not seen. And you use them yet to derive the field-like and damping-like torque, which are then somehow big. So it's kind of strange to some extent.
Even for, okay, so here.
I mean, I can see phenomenologically that this works out, but somehow, microscopically, I would be hesitant to attach much value to, let's say, these quantitative parameters.
Yeah, I'm not saying that quantitative here. Okay, so here, I know that there is uncertainty in this parameter. It could be wrong by factor 2 or something, and this number could be again wrong by factor 2 or something, and I just want to first check whether the number come out of the right order of magnitude.
But to remember this, is there no adiabatic torque at all?
Okay.
Is that the question? Is there no adiabatic torque?
I think there is some complication due to the difference in the register between bottom and cobalt.
Right, so some of the polarization, you don't know which polarization to put in because the current mostly flows in the platinum. So the polarization is much reduced. So what I'm trying to say is that it's a little bit, let's say, taking the adiabatic torque and pretending that is understood, and then sort of plugging in this chiral derivative is a little bit shaky because the adiabatic torque, as parameterized by polarization, I think is not on firm grounds.
On the experiment.
Experimentally, but also I would say theoretically in these materials. Yeah, I don't know. You don't really know what to do when you have strong spin orbit coupling to count well for this polarization. So.
Okay.
I mean, I think it's kind of a need for logical interpretation. So, more quantitatively, I would be a little bit. A little bit skeptical.
Ask a little bit from the analysis that you do. So, if, for example, you had a more complex material, where now the spin orbit coupling was not rushed by light. And then that gauge transformation now would have to be much more complex.
Yes.
In the reality, it's a beautiful way of saying, okay, I can derive it and see it clearly from this linear response, so putting this linear response with this covariant derivative that you use. Once it's getting more complicated, I mean, at the end of that, if I chose to use linear responses there, I guess one should capture the same physics eventually. To what extent, at some stage, maybe when the materials are more complex, the structure are more complex, or the interfaces, maybe the advantages of this derivative approach may be limited, I would say. It may be, or at least for quantitative analysis.
Yes.
Because then you would have to, it would be just as hard to find the correct gauge transformation for it. Is that correct?
Yeah. I agree with you that here problem becomes drastically simplified because of certain structure in this Hamiltonian. But at least for this particular Hamiltonian, we can drag
it's
a lot of information. Okay, then probably I guess I better skip this. Okay, let me just mention one thing. So by applying the same technique to spin-dependent magnetic field, that chiral derivative leads to the prediction that something extra should appear in spin-dependent magnetic field. And let me try to estimate that spin-dependent magnetic field for these two experiments. One is on manganese on tungsten, and the other is iron on iridium. And both of them, in the first experiment, they reported chiral magnet, like I guess it is a cycloidal magnet hydrogen profile. And in the second paper, they reported scummion formation, scummion lattice formation. Let me just try to estimate magnitude of these two terms for these two experiments. Now, for the first experiment, it is a helical structure, so there is no scummion. The first term is zero. Now, for the second term, well, they provided a DM value and exchange value, then I can decide what this KR is, and then they also reported this period of this precession. From that, I can estimate the space derivative, and if I plug in that information, I get something like 140 Tesla, which is huge. And for the second experiment, the first term is over the order of 10 to the 4 Tesla. Yeah, very large. Here the scummion spacing is something like 1 nanometer. Second term, I don't know, because it seems that here something beyond simple interface spin orbit coupling is going on. So I don't know how to estimate KR. So I don't know for the second term. So anyway, in either experiment, this effective spin-dependent magnetic field is extremely large. And I don't know what kind of electron transport is going on in this experiment when we inject the current. I have no idea.
In that case, this perturbation approach is probably also doubtful.
OK, yeah. Yeah, anything, something really big, you know. All I can say is that something really big is there. Yeah. I know that this number is too large, but if you just honestly plug in the number given in the paper and use this formula, then this is the number.
Maybe seeing the outsider question, because what is this spin-dependent magnetic field here?
Electron is moving in non-uniform magnetic texture. Then this non-uniform magnetic texture generates effective gauge field. Mm-hmm. And if you take a curl of it, it will generate some magnetic field. Yeah. And this is exactly that.
Yeah, I think the problem is that the Vedic approximation breaks down in there. Otherwise, you would expect it if it's following, then it's an orbital effect. If it was adiabatically and it was correct approximation, like in the manganese silicon, then it would be okay, because it's an orbital field. But when you have 10 to the 4 Tesla orbital field, you have a quantum modified physics. So
I agree with you. All I can say is that electron transport will not be usual. Something strange should be there.
Now, in your description, where you have this derived curve, I come from the semiconductor community, and this is a ballistic, in a ballistic picture, you can view this well-defined, but it's not robust. I mean, to be robust, we know that you have to have other competing interactions.
Yes,
there's a house that would fix the quantization axis so that you could have some kind of persistence. So do you expect to disorder to
Actually, that was one of my concerns when I started this calculation, but it turns out that the existence of magnetism suppresses that problem a lot. So we did the calculation in the presence of, for instance, disorder, and the, it does not change much. So situation without magnetism and situation with the magnetism seems to be very different.
So somehow it gets stabilized by the exchange.
Now, finally, my question for you. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the answer to this question. First, I've used two-dimensional model to describe three-dimensional systems. And I don't know how reliable this approximation is. We have tried to calculate, together with Mark, for instance, field-like talk in three-dimensional calculation. And as far as field-like talk is concerned, it seems, you know, we can make a rather reasonably good match between 2D model calculation and 3D calculation. But for other predictions, I don't know. This is one thing. And second thing is that in my analysis comparison with the MIT experimental data, I completely ignore spin hole effect. And I wonder if spin hole effect can generate DM interaction. There I assume that all the DM interaction is from interfacial spin hole coupling. And I don't know the answer to the second question either.
The spin hole effect is non-equilibrium, whereas the Lipinski Maria was the equilibrium thing. So
you said the answer is no.
I would say if it affects it at all, it would be a very small perturbation.
Yeah, then I'm pleased to hear that.
Okay, I've been wrong before.
Third question. At the end of last month, Hiro presented at the workshop that there is a very phase contribution to damping light or anti-damping light curve, which could be very large. But somehow, in my calculation scheme, I cannot capture that contribution. I don't know whether it is hidden somewhere in this calculation or I don't know.
So Rembert, I must say, I would like to say that Mr. This torque can be called also Downey van der Bijl torque, because Rembert calculated it without knowing it in a Rashba, like, you know, in the paper on 11,
okay.
2011. And he, you know, he does linear response Rashba like you do, so he does capture in that linear response. I don't know, maybe that derivative approach that you do, you don't capture those somehow.
Yeah, I don't understand.
So the paper of the 2011? Maybe in 2011 with I mean, he doesn't recognize it to be, but it's there.
Okay.
It doesn't have a ring to it as a name. Well,
in the Netherlands, it means of the X. So
of the X. So of the X down torque, we can call it.
May I make a very nasty remark? Because we had in this conference, we had a couple of spin schools people, and I had the idea the best thing we can do is to take a couple of months off and wait until
that
was principles calculations, everything will be included there.
Mm-hmm. That was included in the blue gold folks' work.
So, looking back over the history of transport, how many problems were solved with first principles calculations?
History of physics.
I think they can, for example, yeah, now the mixing conductance of Yeek. That was a big surprise. And I think they are getting better.
I do it, right? I'm just saying, you know, if you.
No, but I think you have to do it all now, of course, all fully relativistic and stuff and so forth. And that is something which obviously is very difficult for us to do analytically. While there, just put it into the computer and crank it and some.
Right, but the question is. The issue is getting insight out of that type of a calculation rather than just a number.
Yeah, but they can sort of switch things off selectively.
Yeah, that's just that you could do an experiment like we've discussed all the time. We've been discussing that to turn things on and off and the experimental numerical approaches to.
Right, but so what is the virtue of this type of calculation? Do I think the answer to his first question is absolutely not, as one of the co-authors on this paper. However, that's a nice simple model that shows you the relationship between all the different processes that are important in the problem.
I think
that's something that you learn that you're not going to see from the first principles calculation.
It can be very useful, I think, in analyzing and understanding the first principles calculation. Right? Because
for example, but this is. At least I don't view this as something that's quantitatively important for the analysis of experiments.
Or predictive, at least, right.
But I think if you look into it and see how all the different things are related to each other, you come away with a better understanding of what might be important in the first principles calculation.
I
agree.
So, are you finished with your question?
Yeah, this is my last page.
Okay, then I think it was a good time to finish. The questions are partly already answered, but it's exact in time now.
Sorry, no more questions.
Sorry?
No more questions, or
you can have
questions or cookies.
The questions are even allowed during the cookie break after the next talk. So I think we should thank the speaker.